Before I begin today's episode, I want to share some exciting news. This fall, Immigrantly is partnering with Home is Distant Shores Film Festival as one of their media sponsors. For those of you who don't know what it is, this film festival is a celebration of immigration and refugee stories through films and music videos. The film festival, which is in its second year, is a collaboration between International Focus, U.S. Committee for Refugees and Immigrants, North Carolina, and Verve Films, based out of Central North Carolina. And it will take place in Raleigh-Durham area in September this year. Submissions are currently open at Film Freeway. You can visit the festival website at internationalfocus.org/film for sponsorship or event partnerships, and film submission website link is on our Facebook page. Now to today's guest. In the summer of 2018, the co-hosts of The Dennis and Judy Show, it's a New Jersey-based radio show, hurled racial slurs at New Jersey's Attorney General, Gurbir Grewal, while they were discussing his directive to suspend marijuana prosecutions. Grewal is the second-generation Sikh American. One of the co-hosts, Dennis Molloy, said he was unable to remember the Attorney General's name, so he would refer to him as the guy with the turban. Turban man, Judy Franco, the other co-host, replied. Molloy went on to say, addressing the AG, "If that offends you, then you don't wear the turban. And maybe I'll remember your name." This is not the first time the Sikh community in the U.S. has been targeted, and it wasn't the last. For today's guest, fighting this kind of racism is personal. Dr. Simranjeet Singh is a writer, a religious scholar, activist, and author. He regularly speaks on issues of diversity, equity, hate, violence, race, and religion, inspiring others around him. He also frequently offers his perspectives to television, radio, and print media. And today he is on Immigrantly to share his story with us. Welcome to Immigrantly. I am your host, Sadia Khan.
If I fictionalized the story, I could not have come up with something more unbelievable. And I think there's something similar that comes with how people who don't experience racism like I do or like you do, like it's kind of for them, they just don't know. And like, how are they supposed to know if it's not their reality?
Welcome, Simran. I'm so excited to have you here.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
So I will start with a question that you ask the guests on your podcast, Spirited. Who are you at your core and what drives you?
It's strange when the question is turned on you. Like, oh, this is such a hard question. I should stop asking it to people. Okay, so the one thing that I believe about people at their core, based on my own tradition as a Sikh, we're taught that we are all embodiments of the same divine light. Mm. So I believe that. And so I believe that about everyone else. It's harder to believe that about yourself sometimes because you know your own flaws and all that. But I theoretically believe it. I'm trying to live that way and see that light in everyone and in myself.
But when you say you believe this about others and not yourself, are you then assuming that others don't have flaws?
You know, it's harder sometimes to overlook your own shortcomings. I don't know. I think some people are wired differently. And for some people, it's easier to see shortcomings in others and easier in yourself. And yeah, I think part of it is how I was sort of how I grew up in sort of a racialized identity and was always having to look at myself as being assumed to be inferior. And maybe I've internalized some of that. I don't know where it comes from. It's a strange thing for me to try and turn around this idea on myself and say, well, actually, if you believe this, then you are as divine as everyone else. I'm like, oh yeah, that's probably true. I should live that way. I should think that way about myself.
And so what drives you?
What drives me is, I think this one's a little easier, probably because maybe I'm overly simplifying it. I think just the desire to be happy. And so that's probably something that's shared among most people. And I think, you know, the the paths we take to find happiness and joy in our lives can look very different. But I think that's what I like try and do every day. And so that's from early morning when I wake up and, you know, my kids are young and I wake up with them and we hang out and play. And then I go to work. Like all of that, my work, I find fulfilling and brings me happiness. Being outside, exercising, like all those things. And so I just constantly find myself choosing to do things that I think will bring me more happiness. And so that's probably the most active driving force.
So you're a second-generation American. Correct. You're not an immigrant.
Correct.
Not Your myself. Parents are. They came from Punjab,
exactly.
India, right?
Exactly.
Have you ever had a conversation with your parents about why they chose to come to the U.S.?
I have. And there are a few reasons. I think the sort of stereotypical story of looking for more opportunities, thinking that this would be a place where they would have a higher ceiling and more potential, and particularly for their kids. And so I always saw that as like a strange explanation until now I have kids and I'm like, oh, I would do anything for them. I would pack up everything and go somewhere else if it meant a better future for them. So that makes more sense to me now. I think the less stereotypical part of the story is that they left Punjab when it was in political upheaval in the 70s. And, you know, that kind of climaxed in the 80s and early 90s. And so it was in many ways a release from tension as much as it was a search for opportunity. So there was both the push and pull at the same time.
That's something that we see with immigrants. Immigrants are on a wide spectrum when it comes to why they came here. Because when I think about my story, I don't know why we came here. Like, I know because, like, my husband and I, we came for college. But I wasn't ready to come here. And I learned to love America over a period of time and not instantly. Moving on, you are originally from San Antonio, Texas.
That's right. Yeah, I just flew back from there yesterday, actually.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
So what was it like growing up in Texas?
Yeah, so Texas is a strange place for a lot of reasons. I think many of the people who are listening probably know some of the reasons, and many people probably imagine some of the reasons based on stereotypes of Texans. And some of those stereotypes are true, and some are not. And I guess my experience, we grew up in San Antonio, which it's majority minority. It's mostly minorities. And so, and largely Latino, mostly Hispanic. And that's part of the reason that my parents decided to settle there. They felt like there were so many similarities between their South Asian culture in terms of, you know, family values, food, dance, like all these things kind of like meshed, at least in my parents' eyes. And they felt like that it was a very warm and inviting place for them.
Do you also think 70s was a different time? Because if you ask me today, as an immigrant, I am very skeptical about Texas now versus maybe when your parents came, racism was not as mainstream or as normalized as it is right now.
Right. Well, I would say it's probably less that because there was certainly racism that my father encountered. Like, you know, his first memories of being in the States, he was called. That was during, you know, the tensions with Iran, you know, 50 years ago or so. And so he was being called Ayatollah and Khomeini as the racial slurs then. And so that was certainly there. I think the difference with San Antonio that I've been able to identify is that it's primarily comprised of people who have been on the other side of racism. And so they are not necessarily immune from being racist or white supremacy or anything like that, but they're less likely to turn around and do that to somebody else. And I think the other thing is San Antonio is one of the more progressive cities in Texas. And so it's like a little bubble.
Does it have a big Sikh population?
It has a decent-sized one now, but it didn't when I was growing up. We were one of the only families there. In fact, my brothers and I were the only ones with turbans in the city when we were growing up. Our babysitter was Pakistani. They were the only Muslims that I knew, at least that I know were Muslim. We knew some Punjabis and Sikhs from the Gurdwara, and that was really it.
And what was your first encounter with racism growing up? As a child or as an adult? Was it like...
Early. Yeah. The very first encounter was elementary school. I think I was in first grade or second grade. I was trying to go to the bathroom, and the bigger kids, you know, fifth grade was not that big, but when you're a second grader, they're huge. And they basically pushed me out, and they said, you know, your hair is long, go to the girls' bathroom until you look like one of us. Yeah, so that was my first encounter with direct racism, where like I still have that vivid memory. I'm sure there was stuff before that, but this is the one that sticks out to me as like, oh man, I don't really fit in. Yeah, and I tend to think of myself as someone who doesn't really dwell in that sort of negativity. Like, it's not something that I would say when I tell my story about myself. It's not something that is important to me. But then I think about it, I'm like, well, it was traumatic enough that I remember it 30 years later. So there was something to it. And so it must have been important.
Especially as a child, you want to fit in. Like, I look at my girls and they just want to fit in. You stood out because of Durban.
Right.
So how did you, as a child, navigate those emotions? Were you resentful towards your parents because of that?
That's a good question. I don't think so. I mean, I'm trying to think. I've tried to think before. People have asked if I've ever wished that I didn't wear a turban. And so I've thought about that, and the answer is there were moments. Actually, the moment about being pushed out of the bathroom, that's the most vivid memory I can recall of wanting to take off the turban. Nobody's ever asked me if I feel resentful to my parents for that, and I don't think so. Yeah, I mean, part of my experience that's strange, I think, is, and it's hard for some people to wrap their heads around sometimes, is yes, I encountered racism early, often, consistently, but my childhood was still like really happy, and I don't think about racism as being like a major part of my own experience growing up. And so I was never, and I don't think my brothers were like this either. I have three brothers, you know, pretty close in age. I don't think any of us have ever felt resentful about our appearance. I think actually maybe the opposite, that well, definitely the opposite now in sort of retrospect, but I think there were moments, especially in high school in the wake of 9/11, when I actually started being really proud of the fact that I looked different as a form of resistance to racism. Like, it was almost like, oh, if you're going to be racist, then like I'm going to be in your face about my difference. So you have you have to deal with it somehow. Yeah, there was something about, I think, what our parents instilled in us was, if you're clear about what you're doing and it lines up with your values and you're doing the right thing, then like you have nothing to be ashamed of ever.
You know, the reason I asked you this is because as an immigrant parent, I'm always scared because I look at my daughters and I'm like, there is so much else going on. There is so much racism that they have to deal with. And then on top of that, the fact that we have a different culture at home and they speak multiple languages and they look different. I always am scared that what if my kids resented me for that? And I'm so glad to hear your perspective on it because it gives me hope that if you instill right values in your kids, everything turns out fine.
Yeah. Well, let me take that hope away from you now. I definitely was embarrassed of my parents. And not in like, oh my God, you're immigrants and like I'm embarrassed of that, but more like in a normal like high school kind of way, of like, oh, you tell bad jokes, or like, you know, you don't remember my friends' names, or, you know, just give us space, whatever, that kind of thing. But I had this moment a few months ago. I actually wrote about it. It was like the most heartbreaking thing. So I was going through TSA security with my family, and like usually the process is,
it's a random check.
A random check, which is, somehow the guy with the turban always gets pulled aside. So I got pulled aside, and it was the first time I'd flown with my three-year-old. She was three when it happened. She's about to turn four. It was the first time that she was cognizant of what was happening. Mm. And so I walked through with her, and my wife was holding our younger daughter. And she asked why I got pulled over. And I explained, I was like, you know, go with your mom, and I'll be out in a second. And I explained that they were just checking me. But, like, it was in that moment that, like, her thinking about how she'll be thinking about this, I was like, oh, man, she's probably going to be embarrassed at some point that her dad wears a turban. So there is this hope that there's a way to raise your kids so they're not resentful, but they could still be embarrassed or ashamed and like that.
So your work is rooted in who you are, and everything that you do is connected with your culture and your religion. Can you explain that a little?
I guess part of my commitment in this world is to try and help achieve equity for people who are sort of left on the margins. And that really, again, comes from my background as a Sikh. Like, that's what I saw our gurus would do. I mean, that's how they lived, and that's what they constantly talk to us about. You know, and then if we look at our scriptures, that's kind of the primary message. And so that's been my interest always. I think where that really took form was I was a senior when 9/11 happened. Mm. And that is when I first started to see the relationship, or at least the connections of across the country, of how racism manifests itself against all sorts of communities. And in that moment, it was particularly Muslims, Arabs, South Asians, Sikhs. And I was just, I mean, it kind of blew my mind that these people who I knew nothing about and had never met were all of a sudden linked to me as my kinfolk. And so that was like, oh, and kind of witnessing in the post 9/11 context that the people who were the most vulnerable also had the least power in society. Like they at that time especially, like who from the Muslim community or the Sikh community was going to go on CNN and talk about, hey, we're people too. Right.
Simran, did you even ever feel that I'm not even a Muslim, why am I being targeted?
I could say it in this way, like before 9/11, so like during the 80s and 90s, that's when the U.S. began its war with Iraq and Operation Desert Storm. I remember then, like, people called me Saddam and Iraqi as, like, their sort of racist terms. And then later on, it became Bin Laden and Taliban and that sort of thing.
Did you correct them?
No. I mean, usually if people are yelling something hateful towards you, they're not open to any sort of, like, response. And so it would be more, I mean, when I was in middle school, I remember, like, it usually happened on the soccer field. And it would be, so this is kind of the other part of the story of growing up in Texas. Like, San Antonio's progressive. But when you travel with a sports team around to different parts of Texas, then you kind of get a flavor of the uglier stuff. But yeah, I would get in fights in soccer games. Like, people would come after me, and my teammates would stand up for me, and it would get messy. But even in those situations, like, it's not actually about them hating me because they think I'm a Muslim. Mm. They're just, like, angry kids who are, like, whatever, right? And so that was that. I think the time that I started thinking about how to deal with being perceived as a Muslim, even though I'm not, was, like, right after 9/11. You know, our family, we all stayed at home for several days. Mm. And a Sikh man was killed in Arizona 4 days after the terrorist attacks. And the man who killed him called him a raghead and an Iranian and a Arab and a Middle Easterner. Like, he used all these slurs that, like, showed that he very clearly had no idea what he was doing. But he just was angry about the terrorist attacks. And so that's when I was a senior in high school, and in our house, we started having a conversation of, like, hey, this is going to happen. You have to figure out how you want to deal with it. And it was like it wasn't a one-time conversation. It was a long conversation. And the way that my parents would always talk to us was, like, you always think about your actions in a way that lines up with your values. And so at home, we started talking about this. Online, the community started talking about, you know, what do we do? And it became pretty clear pretty quickly that, like, we had to figure out a way that corrected people's racism without deflecting it onto the Muslim community. And so, I mean, then it was, what we came up with was basically a three-part response, which was like, I'm not a Muslim, I'm a Sikh. Even if I was a Muslim, what you're doing is messed up. And, like, let me give you an opportunity to, like, think through why that's messed up. I think what I've noticed recently is I've actually, in a lot of cases, left out, you know, for Americans, three takeaways can be a lot. so now I've usually just come to, like, what you're doing is racist and messed up, and, like, let me explain to you why. And, like, if I get to the part about me being a Sikh, like, that's fine. But, like, getting rid of hate seems to me more important at the moment and in certain situations.
Let's talk about Sikhism. Now, in American society, there are, like, altered views of religion and different religious identities. And some of it is influenced by media portrayal. Do you think it is crucial to have our voices heard more to correct some of the stereotypes around religion and ethnicity and cultural identity? And how much are people aware of Sikhism as a religion? It's fifth largest religion the world.
Oh, so no one in America is aware of Sikhism. I mean, a recent study found 70% of Americans couldn't identify a Sikh in a photo, and, you know, we're the most visibly identifiable community.
I'll give you an example. Yesterday I was doing research for your interview, and I typed something, and the first thing that came up in Google search was, are Sikhs Muslims?
Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, it's a common, I mean, I want to say it's a misconception, but it's not even a misconception. It's like a misconception assumes that you have a conception in the first place, and it's wrong. The thing about America is we don't even, like, think about people who aren't, we don't see ourselves as, right? So, like, Sikhs aren't even part of the equation. And then when, you know, they see someone who looks like me, they're like, oh, this reminds me of such and such person, so he must be an Iranian Ayatollah. And like, okay. Or like, this person looks like bin Laden because that's what I see on TV. So like, it kind of helps answer your other question about why representation matters. I mean, there are a lot of reasons why representation matters. But one of the things is when we have such simplistic stereotypes of who people are on the basis of individuals, or especially what we see in America is on the basis of foreign policy, intense foreign relations. Like, we only really talk about people in other countries when we have a problem with them.
Yeah.
And so if you look like somebody from another country and we have a problem with them, like, you're in trouble, right? And so, like, it's troubling to me that, like, and this is true, I mean, I'm thinking about this for my kids too, like, why is it that the only people that they'll ever see on TV that looks like their dad is going to be a violent terrorist, right? Like, that's really scary to me of, like, how do I correct that? And, like, first of all, it shouldn't be on me to correct that. Mm-hmm. But second of all, what resources do I have to, like, counter something as prolific and powerful as mass media? Like, probably not much. I can do some work at home, but, like, that probably works for 5-7 years, and then all of a sudden she'll be in middle school or high school, and then, like, she's paying attention to them more than she is paying attention to me. So, like, it's something that is a huge problem for lots of communities, and we have so many conversations about why representation matters. Yeah, I mean, I think one of the most dangerous things we do as people, like, it's easy to understand why we simplify. We only know what we know. So, like, if we know one black person, like, they're a representation of all black people. And if they're nice, then black people are nice. And if they're not nice, then you're like, black people are not nice. And so to diversify that is really important. And so right now what I'm seeing is an opening up of space enough that there's tokenization. So, like, you'll have one Muslim or one, I mean, I can tell you who that Muslim is on CNN. There's one black person, one whatever, right? Like, you get tokenized, but you end up reproducing the same stereotype.
Which is not really representation, though. It's more like, okay, showing diversity, which is very different from true representation.
Exactly. Exactly. And, like, if you get a spectrum of people from a community, then you can actually realize that just like any other community you know, it's complicated, right? Like, you have, they're just people. So, like, I don't have to make the case to people that, like, there are good Christians and bad Christians, or good people and white and bad white people, right? Like, it's just, it's taken for granted. But if I was to say, for example, like, it blows people's minds when I say that the fascist leader of India right now is running on a Hindu platform. They're like, oh, no, but Gandhi was a Hindu. And I'm like, yeah, Gandhi was a Hindu. He was a pacifist. But, like, that doesn't mean that Hinduism can't be weaponized by somebody who's tyrannical like this, right? Like, every religion has that. So
I think the only religion that, especially in the West, is considered violent is Islam, right? And we face the brunt of that, because I've had conversations with many people where people will say things like Islam is inherently violent. And I'm like, no, any religion can be politicized and weaponized to control citizenry, to commit human rights violations. And I think America has this notion of creating heroes and villains, whether it's countries, individuals, and it's very difficult to cut through the noise and make sense. And that's something that I find extremely frustrating.
Yeah.
How do you deal with that?
One of my most helpful instruments is history. And to understand that none of this is new is really helpful. Because when you feel like it's all on us to fix in our lifetime, like that's not going to happen. We're not going to fix it.
Yeah.
And also it puts so much pressure on us to change the world that we ultimately never end up feeling satisfied because it's an unachievable goal. And so history is really helpful in that regard. You know, you were just speaking and I was thinking of Edward Said's idea of the good Oriental and the bad Oriental, which is basically when European colonialism was expanding and starting to encounter the world, they created Islam and the Middle East as like the enemy, as the Orient, you know, the Eastern peoples. And they created cultures like East Asia and Buddhism as the good Oriental. And these are like the people who are more like us. And so you see now, I mean, you could see it then, but it's easy to see now what kinds of problems are created with both of those, right? Like the bad Oriental, we still have the same mess of a situation that we've had for the last century. I mean, more than a century. But we also have hugely problematic stereotypes of Buddhists as being inherently peaceful to the point where you have a genocide in Myanmar and people are still asking the question, well, how can this be real? When the real, I mean, when we're asking ourselves that question, it's clear that we've deluded ourselves as to what reality, like we can't accept reality because we're so bought into our myths of who these people are. And so anyway, it's a long way of saying it's really helpful to me to be able to see historically how these structures have worked, both in terms of seeing, like of producing humility within ourselves to say, it's not my job to fix everything and I'm not going to, but also the humility to say, well, it's not just about me and my family and my experiences in Texas. This is like a global thing and billions of people around the world are suffering because of these structures. And so that also produces humility.
So I want to talk about your resource guide that you authored. The guide is called Sikhism, a reporter's guide, which is intended to help journalists report on Sikh culture. What kind of gaps do you see? And you have alluded to that in this interview as well. And what do you think needs to be done, other than what you're already doing, to fill those gaps?
The Reporter's Guide, it came through some work with the Sikh Coalition, a civil rights organization I work with. It came out of an experience that we had working with reporters and learning that many who wanted to cover Sikhism were skeptical to do so because they just didn't know. They didn't know anything and there was nothing out there for them as a resource. And so we said, let's just produce this. Like, it's not that hard. And so we put it together and we've seen an increase in coverage on Sikhism. So it's served its role in that perspective. The lesson that I take from that experience is twofold. One, there are people already out there who are trying to cover these stories and they mean well, but they're under-resourced and they don't know where to go. And so, like anything else, creating relationships with people is the solution. And so once you start doing that, you see what their needs are, then you can step in and help them out, I think, and help yourself out at the same time. So it's mutually beneficial.
Simran, is there an online version of it? Where can people go and find it if they want to access?
There is, and it's on the Sikh Coalition website. So S-I-K-H... coalition.org is where they could find it. The other takeaway from this experience is that even with a guide like this, we're still relying on other people to tell our stories. And you can only get so far with that. And it's not necessarily always possible to open up opportunities or open up doors for yourself to tell your own story or your community to tell their own stories. But again, through creating relationships with people who do that, you can hopefully start that process, I guess is what I'm trying to say. But what else needs to happen is people in positions of power, and this is not journalists I'm talking about. I'm talking about people who are corporate, who are running these companies. Like, they need to have the awareness of that these are issues that we need to address and that there is a responsibility to do so. I think today, Stephen King, who generally is on point with his political analysis, he put out a tweet today saying he doesn't consider diversity as being important in the creation of art.
Oh, wow.
And I think anybody who studies this stuff understands immediately the value that comes from multiple perspectives. But here, I think we're actually talking about something more than just perspective. It's actually like people's lives are at stake.
Hmm.
And for those who are most vulnerable in our society, when your stories are not told and popular narratives continue to dehumanize you, then you're stuck. Like, of course people are going to come attack you on the street when
Absolutely.
They see you, because that's what they've been taught to do, and there's no counter to that. And so that's, to me, that's what really needs to be recognized in a way that I'm not really seeing today.
What I go through as a Muslim American, I would say that I am probably more privileged than a lot of other Muslim Americans, and I don't want to discount that privilege. But what I've experienced, because I came to the U.S. in post-9/11 era. So what I've seen in the U.S. is paranoia against Muslims and people of color. That's what I've seen. And similarly for you, as a second-generation American, Sikh American, it's in what you've lived. That experience cannot be communicated by somebody else who has no idea of that lived experience that you've been through.
I just wrote a children's book biography of one of my heroes.
I was going to ask you about that, by the way. Fawja Singh.
Fawja Singh. And it's a biography, so it's actually about his life. But the crazy thing is, if I fictionalized the story, I could not have come up with something more unbelievable. And I think there's something similar that comes with how people who don't experience racism like I do or like you do, like it's kind of for them, they just don't know. And like, how are they supposed to know if they don't? It's not their reality. And so for me, that really came to my consciousness when I was in college, in graduate school. One of my best friends from high school saw me post something about something annoying, a racist incident that I experienced. And he was like, "I can't believe that happened to you." I was like, "How do you not know that happens to me all the time?" It was one of my closest friends. And he was like, "You never talk about it. Like, how would I know? Like, I assume that it happened and I knew it used to happen, but I didn't know it continued." And that opened my eyes to the fact that, like, it's not necessarily my responsibility to teach white people about white supremacy. But at the same time, like, there is an opportunity for me to help people see what they can't. Or that they don't experience. And so for me, at least, that's been an important revelation through that.
Talking about Fawja Singh, as I was doing research about you, I came across your children's book.
Mm.
And then I started doing research on Fawja Singh. And this is a true story, as you mentioned. Fawja Singh started running a marathon at the age of 89, I believe.
Yeah, yeah.
I wasn't able to find any recent articles about him. So I was a bit concerned. I hope he's fine. And where does this word Fawja come from? When I was growing up, I used to hear this term Fawji.
Mm-hmm.
And Fawji is soldier.
Right.
Is Fawja a derivative of Fawji?
It is, yeah.
It is.
Yeah, exactly.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Is it a dialect of Punjabi that's spoken specifically in India?
I don't know where Fawja comes from as opposed to Fawj or Fawji. Fawji meaning
soldier.
Battalion or army, and Fawja being soldier or warrior.
Oh.
Right. Sorry, Fawji being, soldier or warrior. I guess here's the cool thing about it. His name and it matches up so well with his story. I mean, not in a traditional way of like, this man is a military soldier, but like his perseverance throughout his life. I mean, it's incredible. So he's the first 100-year-old to run a marathon.
Yeah.
He's now 108. He still walks many miles a day. And so this book will come out in August. It's through Penguin and Random House. So it should be, hopefully it'll do well. And to our knowledge, it's the first major press book to feature a Sikh character. And for me, growing up, it was like I would always go to the bookstores and look for stuff on Sikhs. When I was a kid, I would do it in the children's section. When I grew up, I started looking in the religion section, and like, there's nothing ever. And so, again, getting back to the point about representation mattering, like, for kids to see someone who looks like a Sikh, someone who's a Sikh, in the book that they're reading. I mean, I'm so excited about that.
And you share your passion or marathon with Fawja Singh. You run marathons as well.
Or? Yeah, six now.
Yeah.
I actually started because of him. And like,
oh, you started because of him.
I say that I was inspired. I mean, I always ran because of soccer. I ran this. I ran cross country, but never ran a marathon. And the day he finished his at the age of 100 was the day I signed up for my first one.
Wow.
So it was like a mix between being inspired and being ashamed. I was like, man, this guy's 100. I don't have any excuses.
Yeah, that's true. So I follow your Twitter very regularly.
Oh,
how do you keep calm? Because I see other people, you know, being pissed and angry, and I get angry at times, right?
Yeah.
But then English is not my first language. So fitting 280 characters of not being as angry or being too angry gets complicated for me. But there are people who are extremely angry. And whenever I see your tweets, you're like calm and you're just, you know, getting your message across, which is so effective. How do you do that?
I don't know where I learned this lesson. I should reflect on this. But there was a point in my life, I think it was around high school or college, I'll think about it later and get back to you, where I learned that people's racism is not my problem, it's their problem.
Yeah.
And like, it's so hard to be deluded by that because you're the one being targeted. And there was a point at which one of my spiritual mentors, we were talking about something like this, but historically, as an example of like how we ought to live. And he was like, why do you think the gurus, the Sikh gurus, in moments of being targeted were able to love back? And I was like, I don't know, like maybe they didn't like feel any pain or, you know, anything like that. And he was like, well, actually, like they did. Of course they felt pain. They were humans. But they realized that they felt so much compassion for other people's pain that they could recognize when they were hurting on the inside. And so it was a lesson for me on people's hate. It has very little, it has nothing to do with it. They don't know me. Most of the time, they don't even know what community I belong to. Like they mean to get someone else. So it really has nothing to do with me. And so I think once I learned that, it's made it a lot easier to not get upset when people come after me.
And you have a wonderful podcast, Spirited.
Thank
How
you.
Is that experience going?
Oh, it's so fun. Yeah,
It is fun, right?
I wish I had started podcasting like 5 years ago. I wouldn't do anything else. It's like the most fun thing. You just like sit and hang out with people you want to hang out with.
Yeah, it is so much fun. And I've been doing this for a year. And I have met the most amazing people. And I know that if I wasn't doing podcasting, I could never share the same physical space with them. All the celebrities are doing it, which sometimes makes me angry. I thought this was space for like creative people, not celebrities. I mean, they are creative people, but in different ways. But like, yeah, it bothers me, but that's fine. There are 750,000 podcasts out there.
Is that true?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
So before I end my interview, I always ask my guests this question. If you were to describe America, how would you do that?
I would say America has two competing narratives at all times. And this is probably true for most modern nation states. Two simultaneous truths. And when I get so much flack when I say one and not the other, you know, if I say online that America is a beautiful place and has really admirable values that it is beholden to and strives for, people get upset and they're like, well, you're erasing the experience of racism and hate and genocide. I'm like, yeah, I'm not erasing it. That's also true. But if you say that America is built on the backs of, you know, white supremacy and religious supremacy and hate and slavery and, you know, genocide of indigenous people, then people will say, well, why do you hate America? There's all these beautiful
exactly.
things.
Yeah.
So I think I think both are true. And I think that's kind of the, I don't know, it's probably my perspective on humanity as well, right? Like it's so hard for people to be able to uphold two competing truths at the same time. I don't know why that is. I mean, I ascribe a lot of it to how we're taught in schools that according to the scientific method, there's always one answer. There's always one truth. What is that one truth? There can't be two real things that are objectively true or good or valuable. And like that's where we get this like American exceptionalism of like America has to be better than everything else, because if it's not, then like what are we doing here?
Yeah.
Right, and like the same with white supremacy, all these sorts of things. And so, yeah, for me, it's really important that we learn to hold multiple truths. And in the story of America, I think both of those are absolutely true.
Thank you so much, Simran. This was wonderful. Thank you for coming.
Of course. I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone, for tuning in and for letting us into your homes, your daily commutes. Your support helps us to create great content. Don't forget to tune in next week. Bye for now.